And we've still got open lines for you right here on Coast to Coast AM, so let's get ready to rumble. I shouldn't say that. I don't have a copyright on that, do I? Let's get ready to make a few phone calls. And welcome back to Open Lines, and let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Glendale, California. John, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, good morning.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. I like to talk about this, the weather, the changeable weather we have. I don't call it global warming because I don't believe in the causes. One of your callers espoused the common held beliefs that the, you know, the burning fossil fuels and everything. There's a problem with that because, you know, we've had volcanoes that spew these fossil fuels out before there were ever man on the earth.
That's right.
And I think people forget I'm 57, a couple of years shy of your age, I guess. And they forget they used to talk about the hole in the ozone and that there was a hole in the ozone and it was getting larger, primarily over the North Pole. And I think the reason they don't talk about that anymore from my own research, and I'm not a scientist or anything, although I've had some college and worked in with the physical sciences, is that we detonated most of our atmospheric test of our atomic weapons, and so did the Russians, literally dozens, as far as I understand from reading about it, over the North Pole. And we detonated some of them as high up as 200 miles. And some of these, a lot of these, in fact, were hydrogen bombs that I don't even believe we build hydrogen bombs anymore. They're so powerful. They were, you know, something like 20 to 40 times more powerful than the atomic bombs we dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Oh, yeah, and the radiation stuck around forever.
And one of your guests that you had on that wrote a book about us going to the moon and possibly not in the way that that's publicly disclosed, even admitted from his scientific research, we tried to blow a hole in the Van Allen belt with a hydrogen bomb and actually made that portion of the Van Allen belt more radioactive.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
So, you know, these things take time. It's just like throwing a big rock in the Great Lakes. You know, the ripples from the waves don't reach the other side immediately.
It takes a while. Indeed, it does. Hey, you know, every once in a while, I'll talk about my buddy in St. Louis who is a cook, and he cooks outside of clubs for people who want to eat hamburgers and bratwursts. But he's out there during any kind of weather. It's Greg. Greg, how cold is it out there right now?
Oh, George, we're probably looking around, I don't know, 5-3 degrees. I think wind chill's below, say maybe 5 below wind chill.
You're in front of this big barbecue pit out there, and you're all bundled up, no doubt. And people are actually out there buying food in the frigid temperatures.
That is correct, George. They come from all over to get the hot food, and we do it, keep delivering it despite the cold.
Well, you stay warm, Greg.
Hey, you know I love you, George. You have a good evening.
Okay, yeah, he's out there in St. Louis. It's 5 degrees. He's out there bundled up, cooking for people coming by. I guess he does real well. I think he made $500,000 last year in his pocket making hamburgers and hot dogs, I think. Next up, we go to Alabama. First-time caller, Matt, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Matt.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good. Would you wait outside in 5 degrees for a hamburger?
Probably not. I mean, I was a Marine, so I'm used to like bad temperature. But probably not. The reason why I'm calling is because I have had these previous dreams, and certain events have occurred, prophecy, I guess.
Now, but you don't know it's going to happen until it happens, right?
Well, that's the thing. It's like I've had this one big dream, and it's occurred 3 times in my life.
Now, what is it?
Basically, what it is I'm in Alabama, and there's some event occurs, basically, that I see Birmingham going up in flames. The whole city's like rioting and going crazy.
Jeez.
And then on my way there, basically my wife, she gets vaccinated and she dies from the vaccine.
God.
And I go to try to find my stepmother, and every time I get to the house, she's gone.
She's gone.
Never there.
Which means maybe she is gone herself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. But basically, the place I'm currently employed, I had the same dream showed that I was employed here before I even got employed.
So you're having all these again?
Basically, they're actually occurring, and they're becoming a lot more frequent. It's the scary part.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, basically, I've had seven parts of the dream come true. From the 6th to the 7th, it was like a two or three month period that it occurred. And nothing's occurred yet, but, I mean, it's been really strange that it's happened like this. And I've had dreams to tell about future events, and they have actually occurred.
Do you have any asteroid dreams?
No, nothing. Basically, my dream is the part after I go to Birmingham, I go and try finding the people who caused the destruction. And
did you find them?
I don't know. I can't remember that part.
All right. Well, if you do, you got to let us know. Next up, we go to Athens, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Robert's up with us. Hey, good morning, Robert.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I have a solution for the creation versus evolution debate in schools.
Okay, what would you do?
Just teach facts, because there's a lot of that we don't know. And it's they're based on either a religious text or a racist model of, human origin.
See, that's the problem. Science would say we're teaching the facts. Theologians would say we don't have facts. We're doing it based on faith.
We're not, though. I mean, the evolutionists come from one side and the creationists come from the other, and the Big Bang Theory and this and that, but we don't, they're all theories. And I think we need to just teach the facts, say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. We have the fossil records. I mean, I had a professor in college who we went to a quarry. I'm from Northern Illinois originally. And, we were looking at fossils. I was like, well, what are these fossils? And he said, I don't know.
but that's the best answer. If he doesn't know.
Oh yeah, he has a PhD. I mean, he used to drill oil wells, etc. But he said there are shells of fossils, that we pull from the earth that we just don't know what they are, because no one was around back then. So I think if we just teach the facts and say, hey, kids, and your parents might have another theory, but we just say what we do know.
Of course, if they did that, it would be a 5-minute class.
No, it really wouldn't, because we could move on to other things that are more important.
Well, I like the idea, though, of just telling it the way it is, the truth. That's what we do on this program. Let's go to Redding, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
George, great pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you.
A lot of people have been talking about precognitive dreams and stuff. I've had precognitive dreams since I was a little kid, and I mean, sometimes it can be pretty disturbing when something that you've seen in a dream comes true. And a little less than a year ago, I had one. Sometimes you daydream while you're just kind of standing around working or something. And that's what happened on this particular occasion. I've got a next door neighbor who has a couple of young boys, and one of them is, real precocious, a cute little kid, likes to crack open rocks next to my driveway and see if there's dinosaur fossils and stuff like that. But, I'll be working
That's
on my
cute.
Car, and he'll come over and he'll talk to me and ask me what I'm doing.
How old is he?
He's about 9.
That's funny. That's cute.
Beautiful kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I have a big rock collection, so we kind of had,
something in common there. Yeah.
It was, just a great thing to talk about, and I gave him some of my fossils for his show-and-tell class and stuff. So one day I'm out trimming the hedges, and nobody's around. I'm all by myself, and I have this horrible vision come through my brain of a little kid getting hit by a car.
Oh no!
And I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible image.
Just popped right in your head.
Yes, I mean, out of nowhere. I mean, and the first reaction I had was, "Where where the heck did that come from?
Yeah.
Why am I thinking that? I mean, you know, I mean, you kind of question your sanity when something like that pops into your head, because there wasn't any precursor, nothing that would, you know, suggest, well, this is where your mind should, you know, it just happened. And so I'm standing there trying to figure out, well, okay, why am I thinking of this? And okay, if that happened to you, what would you do? What would you say? If you knew for a certainty that a child that belonged to a neighbor had been killed, what would you say to their parents? You know, just, you know, let the gears were turning. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what would I say, you know? And there's really not a whole lot that you can say under those circumstances. And no sooner had I sort of put this thing out of my head, poof, there's this little boy, Joey, standing on the other side of my green waste container as I'm...
This is the little 9-year-old?
Yes, the same one, yeah. And he's, you know, how are you doing? And he starts to tell me this story about this big truck that had come past the house. It was all jacked up with the giant knobby tires and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently he was real impressed by it. And as he's pointing out to the street and he's sort of motioning past the house, you know, simulating where the truck had gone, he suddenly begins running down my driveway, just stopped in mid-sentence, began running down the driveway towards the street. And as he began to do that, around the corner on my street come two kids in their little Japanese imports, and they're racing one another right behind one another. I mean, you know, and doing 65 miles an hour on a 25 mile.
In a residential.
Yes. And I just, you know, in that moment, I'm thinking to myself, he can't possibly be planning to run across the street, you know, because little kids, you know, look both ways before they cross, all that stuff they teach them in school. And I'm just thinking, you know,
it's happening.
Yeah. I can't believe this. And I, you know, so in that moment, I'm, you know, you're trying to gather your wits about you and everything. And I'm just thinking, you know, Joey, you know, stop, where are you going? Slow down, stop, you know. And he didn't slow down. He just kept running. And, you know, so a little bit louder, a little bit more emphasis, you know, Joey, come on, stop. And just kept running. And there's cars parked in front of my street. So he's sort of cutting out into the street between these cars at the end of the driveway. So I know the drivers of these imports cannot see him. And
they're coming barreling down,
yes,
right?
Yes. And I mean, there was no question in my mind that at the rate he was running and the rate these cars were going, that there was going to be this intercept right at the end of my driveway. And so I just, with everything I had in me, I yelled his name and the, you know, Joey, stop. And he was
like, you were mad at him, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It just, I mean, you know, like a drill instructor would yell something at you in basic training, you know, just, but he was 3 feet out into the street and he spun on his heels and the two cars passed inches behind him, just, whew, whew, just like that. And he never saw them.
Oh my God.
And they never slowed down. They never hit the brakes. They kept right on going.
He would have been smashed.
Yes. It would have been exactly what I'd seen in this little precognitive daydream.
Man, there is something. There is a mechanism within our system, consciousness,
you know,
that it's out there.
There has to be something. I mean, whether it's a, you know, the little boy's guardian angel or you know,
somebody was telling you something.
Oh yeah, I mean,
it's miraculous.
In that instant, it became very clear to me that, you know, that there was a reason that happened, and then it became clear to me. But you know, I still couldn't understand why, you know, such a bright little boy would, you know, head on down the street. And so his brother had just gotten off the school bus and saw the whole thing. And, you know, the next thing you know, his dad yells for him to come in the house. But he never came out and talked to me. So the next day I went over and I talked to his dad and I said, you know, do you know what happened yesterday? And he says, well, I heard that, you know, Joey was going to run out in the street. And I said, yeah, but did he tell you what had happened? And so I explained the whole circumstance, you know, with the daydream, the precognitive thing and everything. And he says, well, it's kind of interesting you say that, because he says, Joey has something called obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked across the street as he was talking to you about the truck, and he saw a kitty cat across the street that looked just like the one that we lost some weeks ago.
He was focused just
and
on that
in that moment, that little kitty cat became everything. He didn't see the car.
He shut off everything else.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's just a miracle that he stopped when I yelled at him. But, you know, I mean, I don't know why, I don't know how. But all I can say is I just, you know, really, truly give thanks that whatever that mechanism was, it was there
it
in that
kicked
moment.
Kicked in for you.
Oh, I mean, you know, the idea of seeing such a beautiful child hit by one and possibly two cars right after the other, I just...
You saved his life.
Even now, I mean, it just gives me chills.
That's a great story, Mark.
Well, thanks, George.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right, that is a great story. Newburgh, Oregon. Suzette, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Hey, lately quite a few of your guests you've been mentioning about expecting another event or something like that before the market finally really crashes.
Yeah, we feel it.
Yeah, well, actually, we have a friend, and he's into ham radio, and he's been, you know, doing his license stuff. So he gets on these websites a lot, I guess, for his ham radio thing. But anyways, he gets on the government FEMA kind of website.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so anyways, he called today, and he was saying, well, hey, you guys might want to get your stock up of food because FEMA is just given orders to give millions. 4.5 to Washington, 3.6 to Oregon, and 3.5 to Idaho for what they say food and shelter that they're planning on handing out. So
wow.
I don't know what the event that they're expecting is, but I find that interesting.
They know something.
Possibly.
I know. Thanks, Suzanne. TJ, driving in Iowa. Hey, TJ, go ahead. Couple minutes.
Yeah. You know, there was a guy that called. His girlfriend called him quite a while back, that he was going to fly over Area 51. And I had to get out of the truck, and I missed it. And then it was later on I heard you talking about it again, and then I lost it, and I never did find out if that guy actually flew over Area 51.
We don't know if he did or not, because he never came back to us. And, of course, we've got the old tape from Art years ago of the guy who was playing around, and he disappeared, too.
Really?
I'm
just kind of curious, because every time I would try and get a hold of you, I could get a hold of you and, when you was talking about it. I was just off wondering if he ever did make it across or whatever happened.
I'll tell you what, if he tried, they probably talked him down or they flew him down, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Dangerous stuff. Okay, be well.
Okay, thank you, George.
Bye. See you later. Let's go to Redlands, California. David, go ahead, real fast, Dave.
Hi, George. I like your show. I just got to say that to you first off. And you have so many guests like Jim Mars, and I don't know if you ever had Bill Cooper or any of those.
No, Bill died before I started doing the show. I think Art might have had him on once before he died in this police shootout.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that on the videos on YouTube he has and read his book, The Hold the Pale Horses.
Yep.
Really phenomenal information.
I would have loved to have interviewed him. I'll tell you that, David.
Yeah, you both. Like right now, I just wish I could ask you a bunch of questions, but I know we only got so much time. But my main question was, how do you see the New World Order coming to be? I mean, obviously, it's going to come through an economic collapse. As they're further money with bailouts, giving money here, stripping money here from this program to give it to this program. Eventually, money runs out and you can't move it any more than you can push it, you know?
It'll be done, David, I think, on a number of fronts. One would be the economic collapse. One would be wars. One would be a false flag, whatever it might be. I don't know what it would be. The other would be the creation of disease and pandemics to control population. Isn't it interesting? That seems to all be happening now. But that's how they're going to do it, because they want to control. As I said in a magazine, in Atlantic Magazine, I laughed about this 5 or 6 years ago. You probably laughed about it, but we're not laughing anymore. Coast to Coast continues in just a moment. We'll be right back. Ever wonder what it's like to sleep in a funeral parlor? Well, I spoke with paranormal investigator and demonologist John Zaffis and Carmen Reed, who told her story about living in a haunted former funeral parlor and the disturbing details of what her family endured. The events, of course, were depicted in the Hollywood film, The Haunting in Connecticut. Back with that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We've got John Zaffis and we've got Carmen Reed as well. Carmen Reed is a mother of four, comes forth after being silent for more than 15 years with a story of terrifying events that her family had endured after renting a home that was formerly a funeral home in Connecticut. Carmen is now discussing publicly the details that were left out of the book In a Dark Place and the documentary A Haunting in Connecticut. Her intentions in going public now with her story are to tell the whole story of the family's ordeal, as well as bringing awareness of the reality of the spiritual realm. Here she is. Hello, Carmen. How are you?
Hi, Hello, George. How are you? I'm wonderful.
Good. Thank you for coming forward with this. And, John, you're with us now, too.
Yes.
Okay. Carmen, tell me a little bit, first of all. Let's go back to before the family moved into the funeral home. How was life with the family?
It was great. I had four wonderful kids. They were rambunctious. My sons were more like Huck Finn types, always bringing home some critter or another. just enjoying life.
What precipitated the move?
Well, my son's illness. My son, when he turned 13, developed a lump in his neck. And up in the area we were in upstate New York, they didn't have any childhood cancer treatment centers. So we needed to get him near a teaching hospital for the best cancer treatment for a child.
So you up and leave. Pretty dramatic, pulling out your roots, wasn't it?
It was. Well, I'm an Air Force brat, so it wasn't dramatic for me, but it probably was very dramatic for the kids.
Absolutely. And so off to Connecticut you go. Tell me about the search for living quarters.
Well, Connecticut's very notorious for not wanting to rent to people with a lot of children, and I had four. Most of the time when I'd go into a place and tell them that I had four children, they said, oh, we only rent to someone with two.
So tell me about how you found the funeral home.
Well, it was actually the last day I spent what I could on a hotel room for myself and my kids, and we were, my son had a sabbatical from his treatment, and we were looking, and the last day I went to go to look at this townhouse in Southington, when I was going to take it regardless, I just had to have a place, and I got there, and the rooms were so small, I couldn't even put a twin bed, let alone bunk beds in a three-bedroom townhouse. But on the way, I had passed this beautiful old colonial with a for rent sign out front. And on the way back, I stopped and begged the man to rent to me.
And there was a funeral home?
Yes, I didn't know it at the time, but there was a sign that was covered up with plywood. And he had told me that he originally bought it to turn into doctor's offices, but the zoning was residential, and he had to keep it residential, which didn't tell me what kind of business was there.
Carmen, when I was in early days of broadcasting, our station was in Detroit, Michigan, and it was an old converted funeral home. And it's got to be one of the creepiest places I've ever worked, especially working the late hours. But it had the, you know, elevator and, you know, the places where they embalm people and everything. Did this house have that around too?
It had a morgue in the basement, but it was an older working morgue. And instead of an elevator, they had a body lift that lifted the body up through a trap door. And it had a hoist that they used to lift it. It wasn't electric yet.
How soon after you moved there did you begin to realize there's something wrong here?
My son realized it the minute we walked into the place. He told me the place was evil, and he started experiencing things, hearing and seeing the younger entity, which was long, dark hair about down to his hips, with black eyes, no whites in the eyes. He started seeing him right away within 24 hours.
Do you believe, Carmen, these entities at this funeral home were bodies and spirits that were brought into the funeral home, maybe, you know, the dead body brought in, but the spirit, you know, followed it? Or were they always there?
I have no way of knowing, George. I mean, I've got my own opinion. My opinion is that they were some human spirits and some evil spirits.
Okay. Tell me about the haunting in Connecticut, the documentary. And John, let me bring you in on that, too.
Okay.
This documentary, Carmen, tell me about that and how accurate you believe it to be.
It's very accurate. The only thing is it was very condensed because of time. It started out to be a 30-minute show, wound up being 2 hours. John played himself. He was awesome. It was very accurate. They did roll the entities into one. They took three of the entities and rolled them into one character, which they do for time's sake, but it was extremely accurate.
As you watched,
on the floor.
as you watched this on the big screen, how did you feel? I mean, did it bring back horrible memories again?
I cried. The movie's got a lot of the cancer treatment in it, and reliving that was very, very difficult.
I would say.
When my son was going through his radiation treatment, they wouldn't allow me within 20 feet of him because I was still childbearing age and he was so radioactive. So I had to stay away from him for an hour after his treatment.
Over what period of time, Hart Carmen, did this bombarding occur for your family?
Of the haunting or of the cancer treatment or the whole the 2 years total?
2 years total?
Mm-hmm.
And, John, explain again your involvement, how you got brought into this.
At the point of everything escalating with her son experiencing things and, you know, telling Carmen and sharing it and teasing the younger kids and everything, it just had reached a point where Carmen wasn't quite able to understand what was occurring and what was happening. She asked the doctors if it had anything to do with the chemo. She, you know, had taken him to a psychiatrist, and all these things were just escalating out of control. And he just had reached a point where he totally was isolating himself and keeping himself away from the family. And it just reached a climax one evening after the niece was talking to him and everything, and he got very upset over the fact that she was repeating a lot of the things back to Carmen. That he was documenting and thinking that these things were planting in his mind, and he got outraged over that, and he had gone after her one night and tried to attack her. And at that point in time, Carmen and Al have made a decision to have him removed from the house, and then they started experiencing things. Everybody started experiencing things. They called in a priest, had it blessed. It escalated out of control. And that's when she had made contact with Ed and Lorraine Warren, and that's where I came into the picture and ended up spending 9.5 weeks in that home.
John, of course, now this was a documentary, right? But there's also a movie out, or are we talking about
George,
one of the same?
Right, no, it was two different things. I was going to say something. There was a documentary done, I believe, 2002, Carmen?
2002. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2002, the documentary A Haunting in Connecticut. That was on the Discovery Channel. I mean,
right.
And now there's the movie out, The Haunting in Connecticut.
Exactly. And, I mean, this is indeed a thriller, The Haunting in Connecticut. Pretty good production, I think.
I loved it. I thought it was very well done. Virginia Madsen playing me was awesome, and Kyle Gallner. And Elijah Cody was playing John. It was just wonderful. I enjoyed it.
Did the documentary fall short?
No, actually, the documentary went into quite a bit more on the Discovery Channel with interviewing Carmen, interviewing me, interviewing Lorraine. And they had a lot more of the accuracy and the more in-detail things that occurred within the case.
But do you think the Hollywood version then also kind of balanced it somewhat, putting aside the fact that they had to do their entertainment, of course? What do you think?
To be honest with you, George, I had put off going to see it. Carmen and I had discussed it. I finally went to go see it this past Monday, and I had called her immediately when I got home because they hit things in the movie that weren't in the documentary. They went in, you know, in depth part of what Carmen and she had endured, what she was going through with the family, with the younger kids going through with the son with the cancer, and to be perfectly honest, they got her right to a T. And the way she handles things, the way she does things, and watching it and everything, I had told her at two different points in time, it hit home base with me. And they touched on several different perspectives of things that transpired in Carmen's home, and it made me emotional with a few of the things. Yes, there's Hollywood hype, but that's Hollywood.
Well, that's
so,
Hollywood. Yeah,
yeah, Hollywood. But there are quite a few things in there that were very accurate, and to be quite honest with you, George, I sit there like a little kid in a candy store when I looked at Eliza Cateas, and I said, holy cow, he does look just like me.
I also think that a lot of it, it's a great scary movie, and it's a safe scary movie. It's not the kind that you're going to go home and you're going to be heavy all night long and worry about it and fret and not be able to sleep. It's the kind that will make you jump and then make you laugh, and then you can go home and forget all about it. The heaviness that transpired in my house didn't come through on the screen, but the message did. You know, if you play with the occult, it's going to backfire on you and you're going to get hurt. But yet, it also entertained you at the same time. So you didn't come out of the movie theater depressed. You came out questioning things, and it took me several days of chewing on it, and I was still thinking about things and realizing the underlying message of things in the movie.
And Carmen, I assume you are no longer living in the old funeral parlor and home.
No, I'm not, and I would not ever move back into a funeral parlor.
Is it still there, do you know?
Yes, it is still there, and still the people there. Are not having any problems, as far as I know, except for the public going by to see their house.
How are your kids today?
They're great. My son is 35. He's never had a reoccurrence with cancer. Yeah. He's never had a major illness at all, which is amazing.
He beat this stuff.
We did. We came out on the other side, George.
What were some of the scariest events for you, Carmen, when you were in the home?
There were so many of them, and I've thought about it a lot. I think... and it's very hard for people to understand this, but there were several times when I was taken into this, I don't know whether you would call it a trance, jump as I was in a coma, but I felt like I was out of my body. And I was taken into this dark place, and in this dark place I encountered other spirits that were there, and they were tormenting themselves, and it was all in different shades of blackness, but you could make out the different characters, and as I passed them, their emotions or what they were feeling permeated through me. So I felt what they were feeling, and they were all negative emotions, human emotions that they were feeling. Like, there were some that were really distasteful and I moved away from. There was anger and hatred and self-pity and different ones, and the biggest one was hopelessness. And I went to move towards it because I've never experienced hopelessness. I thought if I hugged it, being a Southern woman, if you hug something, it's always going to get better. If I hugged it, it'd get better. But as I started to leave the path, I was told that I'd be trapped there for an eternity if I left the path. And when I got back to my body, everybody was praying over me and holding my hand and patting my hand, and they said I'd been gone 8 hours.
Jeez.
And I thought that I would never make it back.
What have you learned about the other side, Carmen, through this event?
Just knowing that it's there is enough, but I learned so much that it would take a book in itself to tell you about how you care for yourself and how you can't take things too seriously. No matter what it is, you can come out on the other side.
You know, and while this was going on for you over this two-year period, I mean, why didn't you just get out of there?
Well, George, that's a big question that a lot of people ask me. When I went to leave, I was working in an office. The phone systems would go down because the entity would come with me. The car would break down on the way away from the house. Just things continued to happen whenever I was around. So it followed me wherever I went, and I felt that I would drag other people in there, and it let me feel that way. I mean, it started attacking people all the way down here in Alabama when I talked to them on the phone.
Wherever you go now, Carmen, do people say, oh, you're the person that was in that movie, The Haunting in Connecticut?
No, most people don't recognize me. A lot of people don't even know who I am. There's Sarah Campbell is Googled quite a bit. They don't connect Carmen Reed with Sarah Campbell. They Google Sarah Campbell instead of Carmen Reed.
Yeah, they changed your name. Did you want your real name used?
I didn't care one way or another, but my children, I've got two nurses and a manager of a business and a truck driver, and they got to live their lives, and I didn't want their names brought into it, although they have been found out. But I don't want them to have to suffer through the publicity torment.
But you went public. I guess you had to know that this would happen to you. I mean, everybody would talk about it. Well, so why go public? Why not just keep it quiet and just try to put your life together?
It wouldn't let me. I tried. I tried to walk away from this several times, George, but people sought me out. They found me through the Catholic Church. They called around Catholic Churches, the production company, until they found me.
Well, I never knew I had Martians in my garden. And I never knew there were aliens on my roof. I got shadow people, and they're living in my basement. Got a funny feeling Bigfoot's gonna be here soon. I was so blind before, I was so unaware. But now I swear I'm seeing Sasquatch over there. On my radio in the middle of the night, and I heard things I need to know. Now I can see the light, and I also see a ghost, 'cause I'm listening to Coast to Coast. Well, you never knew that your baby was a hybrid, but as he grew, you began to see the clues. Now you know the signs, 'cause you learned it from George Norrie. Even while you sleep, you got Martians watching you. I turned on my radio in the middle of the night, and I heard things I need to know. And I can see the light, and I also see a ghost, 'cause I'm listening to Coast to Coast. Or good evening, wherever you may be, whichever world you're living in, whatever century, your voice is always welcome here on my radio. Call in with your space transmitter or your telephone. And I turned on my radio in the middle of the night, and I heard things I need to know. Now I can see the light, to see a ghost, 'cause I'm listening to Coast to Coast, 'cause I'm listening to Coast to Coast.